Dargraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 9, delivered on September 22nd, 2015. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and Yields.
Today, interest rates and yields. Interest rates are something that I've talked about over and over again, and it might begin to get a clue you in that maybe interest rates are important to us here. Okay, so let's try to get a consolidation, because I've been using rate in a number of different contexts. What is another word or term that I've used that is a rate? Madam, can you tell me something else I've used that is almost the same as me? I mean an interest rate? Any other terms? Total blanking on it. You'll hate yourself once I start naming them. Can you think of any other terms that have the same that I've used that probably mean I'm talking about an interest rate? Let's see. Let me see if I can get you started with this. How about, you heard me use the term yield? That's an interest rate. Any other things that I've said? Discount rate. Don't say growth rate. Discount rate. Yeah, I've used a discount rate. It's just an interest rate. Any other ones that I've used? Return? Yes, return. I mean, I've also used APR, effective yield. Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank now. I had one more. Oh, here's one that I don't think I've used it yet, but it's one that might be worth knowing. Opportunity cost of capital. Now this is a longer term, but it's the kind of term that you can just toss out in a casual conversation, and people will be so damn impressed by you. The opportunity cost of capital essentially is a way of describing an interest rate. Now, notice these, I would use these in different contexts for different purposes. But the opportunity cost of capital is a way of explaining or describing that whenever I spend money on one thing, I don't have that money to do something else with. So in other words, if I am looking at a project, I would ask myself the most important question I would ask myself. Okay, I've got $50 million that I'm going to spend on a project. What is the best alternative I could do with that $50 million? If I were to choose to spend it on this project, I am therefore throwing away what I could have done otherwise. And what the question that will dominate your mind as a business person is, what would have been the best thing that I could have done otherwise with it? You decided that you were hungry. So you go and you buy yourself a couple of double cheeseburgers at Dairy Queen. They've got them on sale right now. They're really, really good price on them. A little on the salty side. You'll be swilling water. But I mean, anyway, focus, please. Look, the thing is, though, that once you have bought those two cheeseburgers, I think I paid like $3.57 for two double cheeseburgers. That's not bad. I no longer had that money to do other things with. I could have bought a friend for a few hours on Craigslist. Hell, Tiger Woods did. I could have bought myself something at the store to eat with that. There's always, always an opportunity cost to everything you do. Do you sleep?
Yeah.
Okay. You know you could have been working instead? Well, you got to sleep. There's no question about that. But you could have done something else. We have to recognize that nothing in this life is free. Nothing. I don't want to hear that, well, love is free. No, it's not. I was in the Army. $25. Oh. $35 if you didn't want ugly. I saved the $10 for Denny's. I am so going to edit that out of this podcast. Okay. Okay, that concept of opportunity cost dominates us in our business lives. Look, in our personal lives, we'll just blow money, and you don't think about what else you could have done with it. It doesn't matter how old you are. You're going to be irresponsible like I am sometimes. But in our business lives, we have to be much, much tighter with what we spend money on. I decide that I am going to hire you for a job, and I'm going to pay you $50,000 a year. What else could I have done with that $50,000? I could have bought a computer, a robot. I could have outsourced and gotten two workers in Vietnam for the price of you. Okay? Now, don't look hurt by that, because I have to. That doesn't mean I made a mistake buying you. As it turns out, I did, because you're really a lazy employee. No. It's not necessarily that I made a mistake, but I have to justify that this $50,000, my return on the investment in you, is worth what I'm putting into it. I took my students down to St. Louis a couple of years ago, my finance club students, and of course I got the bitching and the whining, I don't want to be in St. Louis, oh shut up. But as it turned out, we ended up, the Google Maps took us to East St. Louis and things got a little ugly. No, I'm serious. I mean, I was yelling in the back of vans things like, you know, collect the weak people, send them out there, they'll leave us alone. But the thing was that they were explaining that they were trying to get some of the students to take jobs. And it was Travelers Insurance. It's their finance division where they do the credit risk analysis. Really interesting stuff. But he was explaining, look, you know, when I hire one of you, it's going to take you 18 months before you make me a dollar. Because for 18 months, you're going to cost me a fortune. I'm going to be training you. You're going to be screwing up. That's how it is. So I have to justify that investment in you, which is going to put me in the big, bloody red negative territory for a year and a half, 2 years. But then you're going to start to pay off. And so that question then is, are you going to be worth it? That's why they are so picky about whom they hire and all that kind of stuff. And even worse is the next part of it, is because once they have trained that person, once that person is good at what he or she is doing, well, then the other companies that do the same kind of work are going to start trolling for that person. Hey, would you like to come and work for us? We'll give you a much better salary than they're giving you. Why are they paying you this when we could pay you so much more? Well, of course they can, because the other company made the investment, and then they can snatch it up, and they'll pay a higher price. They'll pay a higher salary for the person because they're still saving money on the training costs that they would have otherwise had to do. So in other words, it gets to be a very complex concept, but it's still an opportunity cost of capital, and you are capital in our system. Just like a machine, just like a robot, just like a computer, whatever. Okay, now, some of these other ones, they are used in different contexts, and they do have somewhat different meanings, but keep in mind that they are all representing an opportunity cost in one way or another. They're also representing something else. They are, okay, woman, can I buy you? Don't look at me like that. Can I buy you? What's your price? I'm on eBay. What am I going to see in the last 2 minutes of bidding? The answer you should be giving is, you can't buy me, you aminal. No, you can't buy me. And that's exactly right. We don't buy people. We really, even when we buy equipment, we're not really buying it. Everything is about rental rate. I don't buy you, I rent you. in a job that you do for me. I can buy a computer, but really what I'm doing is I am renting a service, a potential for cash flow from that machine. So in a large sense, these are all representing kind of like a rental rate on capital. When I talk about something like discount rate, I'm actually talking about a rental rate in some way or another. Now let me get to this point that I've already brought up once, and now in chapter 5 of the textbook, they bring it full on to you. Not quite as detailed as I already did, but as I told you before, I kind of layer things. I'll introduce something, and then I'll back off, and then I'll come back to it later so that you're more familiar with the topic. When we talk about an interest rate, the first thing that we have to talk about is a baseline, something that's sitting there like a substrate underneath all interest rates, and that is the risk-free rate. What would be the opportunity cost of capital if there were no risk involved in the use of it? In other words, what does it just cost to give up capital, give up using money for a while? No risk, I just don't get to have it for a while. That's the risk-free rate. It has two pieces to it. The real rate and an expected inflation premium. Not an actual inflation premium, an expected inflation premium. A term here on the side now, and you probably have heard this in other contexts. I don't know if you have or not. But any interest rate that carries the inflation premium or the expected inflation premium is called nominal. Any interest rate that does not correct out that expected inflation premium is called a nominal rate. And that's what you always see are nominal rates. Not quite always, I should qualify that. But almost always, when you hear an interest rate, it's a nominal rate. It's carrying the expected inflation premium. If you subtract out an expected inflation premium, then we call it an adjusted or a real rate. Although I don't want you to confuse that with the actual baseline real rate here. But if it doesn't include that, it's called the real rate. And this would be true of anything. If I took a mortgage rate and I subtracted out the expected inflation premium, I'd have the real rate on the mortgage. Now, interestingly enough, there is a kind of debt instrument where you actually see a real rate. There are some government instruments and even a few corporate instruments that adjust your balance, your principal, your face value for inflation. So in other words, as inflation goes up year over year, what you get paid off and what the coupon is based on is going up year over year. So the face value is $1,000 to start with. Well, and it's like a 10% coupon. Well, if inflation went at 3%, then the face value would become $1,030 the next year, and your 10% coupon would be based on $1,030. In a case like that, the yield on a bond of that kind would be the real rate because the inflation was already adjustment was already embedded in it. If you don't get what I said there, don't worry about it. I'll show you those a little later. They're kind of an interesting animal. They help us see real rates a little better. But anyway, let me get this off the board here, all this confusing terminology. But again, if I say nominal, it's got the inflation premium in it. If I say real, someone has subtracted it out. Here's the problem with that. Technically, we should be talking, if you're going to subtract out inflation to get a real rate, you should subtract out the expected inflation rate, not the actual inflation rate that has been reported. Unfortunately, that's not how it's usually done. Look, if inflation has been running for, say, year one, year two, year three, year four, it's been running at 3%. The government reports 3% year over year over year. I would imagine that the expected inflation premium would probably be pretty well proxied by the actual inflation. You see what I mean there? Because the expectation had built, well, 3% over and over and over again. So taking 3% out of a nominal rate would probably be a good approximation of taking out the expected inflation premium. However, what if it looked like this? Year one, 1%. Year two, 3%. Year three, 5%. Year four, 9%. If I took out the average of these, or if I took out the last of these, or a moving average, I've got a weighted moving average, any one of those would be a bad approximation of the expected inflation premium. Any one of them would be. Because if I'm looking at this, I would bet you the markets, the investment community, global investment community, would probably be pegging somewhere 13 to 14%. For the expected inflation premium for the next year. That's some serious stuff right there. You're going to get a real serious error turning a nominal into a real by taking the average of these or the last of these, because the market is working on expectations of what's about to happen. Here's an even worse one. Here's a worse one. Suppose in year one, you had 5%. Year two, 2%. Year three, 12%. Year four, 8%. I mean, it would be almost, this one I could probably project a trend. But this one where you have it all over the board, that's one I wouldn't even know where to start to take a shot at an expected inflation premium. What are the markets figuring for next year? I wouldn't have any idea whatsoever. Well, I would, but I mean, just as a quick, dirty draw to get a real rate, to turn a nominal, adjust out the inflation, that one, I would have no idea where to start if I was just wanting to take a stab at it. That volatility, which has happened in the past. There have been a few times in American history where you've seen the inflation rate just go up and down, and up and down. Essentially, the Fed was, there was a lot of confidence, and then it was lost, and then there was more confidence. So anyway, when you are taking out, when you are adjusting a rate for inflation, know that you should be using an expected inflation, not an actual. And know that there are some conditions under which the expected and the actual are pretty good, close, and there are some situations where the expected ain't anything like the actual. So that's one of those complications. Anyway, moving forward from there, every interest rate is based on the substrate risk-free rate. And then on top of that is a risk premium, which is characteristic, I put in an extra loop in there, which is characteristic of the security itself. Every debt, equity, whatever, interest rate will have its own risk premium because it is based upon the interaction of three terms. The first one is the default premium, the second is the maturity premium, and the third is the liquidity premium, or sometimes called the illiquidity premium. The deal is this. The default premium represents the risk that part or all of the cash flow promised will not be satisfied. The, again, the risk that all or part of the promised cash flow will not be satisfied. Now, for some instruments, if they're backed by hard assets, it's low. And also, the risk premium is lower based upon certain clientele of investors. So, for example, you might find that at a credit union, your interest rate on a car loan is lower than it would be at a bank, simply because there is a slightly lower risk of default among credit union people than there is in a general bank than among clients of a bank, because a credit union is theoretically supposed to have a tighter clientele based upon specific criteria for acceptance in the credit union, something like that. Also, if you have a high credit rating, you will get probably lower interest rates on loans, simply because you have a demonstrated track record that you pay off your bills. If, on the other hand, you are me, they will. Some people like you, we know damn well you don't pay your bills. Your credit rating, I mean, who knew that they could be negative? There again, there's the default premium. It's characteristic of the instrument, the backing, and the seller of the instrument. And also, interestingly enough, the buyer. Payday loans. There's a buyer of debt. You can sell them a debt instrument very quickly. They'll charge you out the wazoo. That's what they do. The institution is affecting the R sub D. Now, R sub M. This is the one that represents the risk that the interest rate on the security will be adverse to the lender in the future. So, if on a loan, and I've explained this before and I'm going to do it again here to make sure that you understand this concept. Suppose that I get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at 6%. And I, as the lender, the bank, figure for 30 years, I'm going to get a steady cash flow of 6% per year on this loan. But if 5 years from now, interest rates fall to 3%, the borrower is going to refinance. I'm going to get my money back, and I can't lend it out at anything but 3%. I'm screwed. Now, the probability that interest rates will fall becomes higher the longer into the future you look. On the other hand, suppose interest rates go to 10%. I would love to have you pay off your loan so I can relend that money at 10%, but you probably won't. You will hold on to that loan longer than you should, longer than you normally would, because you are paying 6% on capital, and that's adverse to me because interest rates have gone up and I could make 10%, but you're not going to pay me my money back. And the longer you talk about the future, the more likely it is that interest rates will go up. So there is this risk associated with longer and longer securities, that interest rates will turn adverse to the lender. And so we have a maturity premium. For a 1 year, it's virtually nothing. For a 5 year, there's some. And 10 year, and for a 30 year, well, yeah, there is a really good likelihood that interest rates are going to go somewhere that isn't good for the lender. I would really, really love to have that money back if interest rates go up. The borrower's not going to pay me off. And I would really, really hate it if the borrower paid me off when interest rates dropped, and the borrower's obviously going to if interest rates fall enough. So there's your risk. There's your maturity premium. The liquidity premium represents the possibility that it would be hard for the lender to unload the debt if he or she needed to. Most debt instruments now, there are very dense secondary markets. almost anything you can think of. However, some of those really aren't all that great. Like, for example, factoring. If you want to get rid of your accounts receivable, in other words, those are bills that you hold as a company, you're not going to get a whole lot for those. So there is a liquidity premium in there in any interest rate that is charged. That's why. Were you taught in accounting the idea of the terms of an invoice on an invoice? 210 net 30. Have you heard that yet? Okay. The reason that is so aggressive, and I mean I'll do that in my business. I'll give very aggressive. 210 net 30. That's 2% if you pay me 2% off if you pay me in 10 days. Well, that's actually a pretty darn steep thing. And the reason is that if I let that thing ride out 30 days, I have basically lent a buyer the money to buy my stuff. And I've got it sitting there on my books, and I probably can't even sell. If I was desperate for money, I wouldn't be able to sell that account receivable for anything but pennies on the dollar. So that's why that liquidity premium shows up sort of in the backwards way in the terms on an invoice. I mean, I bought a ream of these acetate envelopes to put my very large prints in, and their terms were I've got a credit account with them. Their terms were 5/10 net 45. So they would give me 5% off the total bill if I paid within 10 days. In other words, They're recognizing that there would be a liquidity premium for them if they held that account receivable for 45 days, because they probably couldn't sell it to anyone except at pennies on the dollar. So they want to give me an incentive to pay off the bill fast. Anyway, there you go. There are the parts of it. What does this mean in practice, though? How does this play out? Well, we're talking about the actual world of cash flow. Bear with me here. I'm going to turn this on for a second. I'm going to get something. And I want as much as for you to be not just a robotic business person, but to be able to think and do forward-leaning decision-making based upon what you are seeing out there in the real world. I'm going to show you that yield curve again. Just very briefly, and just a couple of quick things about it. And then I'm going to go on to something else here. And I could very well easily ask you something about yield curves. Although, it might not be there. No. Okay. Yield curve. There it is right now. Now, for our business purposes as business people, we are not wildly interested in very deep theory. But we do have in our thinking a theoretical and a background understanding that is crucial to good, as I called it, forward-looking decision-making. And in this case, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, the FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee, met last week, and they decided for one of their 8 meetings a year to decide on what they were going to do with interest rates. What was it that they made? Do you know, any of you, what the decision was that they made for interest? What they were going to do? They said we're going to keep them where they are. There is a danger. Okay. The danger in not pushing them up is that you could have inflation start to get embedded. And that once that inflation expectation is embedded, even if you try honestly to beat that inflation out of the economy, the markets are still going to hold on to that expected inflation premium until they're nearly dead from you throttling the money supply. So raising the interest rates would address the concern about inflation, but it could also kill off our still fragile economic recovery. But, And I say still fragile for a serious reason. There is no question that there has been sector inflation. It is just essentially every time the Fed shovels money, it's shoveling it through banks. And without the old Glass-Steagall Act, it was repealed in 1999, banks can do whatever the hell they want. And there, a lot of what they're doing is driving stock prices up through their investment activities. So essentially, you're seeing money just turned into higher stock prices, while the rest of the economy is doing not that good. The economy is still fragile, and that's what concerns the Fed. What happened to gas prices in the last couple of weeks? Did anyone notice what gas prices have been doing? Going down. I saw $1.89 a gallon at Quick and Easy. I would have gone in there, but this old big woman likes me, so I'm afraid to go there anymore. So, but look, $1.89 a gallon. That's something that scares the living hell out of any self-respecting economist. Although inflation is a bad thing, deflation is scary as hell. It's something we want to stay on the other side of the universe from, and we keep seeing commodity deflation. Why that's happening is because M1 is still not getting to the people and businesses that need it. The Fed knows it, and the Fed knows that if they pop interest rates, start crushing the money supply, well, the crush is going to come on the real economy, that substrate of consumers and businesses. They'll suffer it, and we'll snap down, and we'll have another recession like we're struggling out of from 2008. Okay, now, brief mention about inflation. And I might have already said this, but I'm going to repeat it right now. Inflation benefits borrowers. Inflation benefits borrowers. It hurts lenders. Especially if the nominal interest rates are not carrying the right expected inflation premium. In a difficult to forecast market, the markets are going to put an expected inflation premium on it, but it can end up that they were wrong. Let's take an example of this. You decide that you're going to finally buy a house. You're 30 years old. You finally found someone to marry, and you've got a couple of kids. And she had them from a couple of previous marriages. I think there were six. You got to buy a big house, And her brother's kind of like he wants to live in the basement and run his meth operation there. Got to buy a house, okay? Let's say that you buy a $200,000 house. Your payments would probably be about $1,100 a month, okay? Where interest rates are now. I'm just taking a stab in the dark at that. Okay, suppose, though, that inflation starts getting worse and worse and worse, stronger and stronger, from 2% to 4% to 8%. Year over year, it's getting serious. Your house probably will go up in value because housing tends to be inflation sensitive. Also, your salary will probably, you'll get cost of living adjustments, but your payment will stay $1,100. So do you see that inflation is going to be your best friend as a borrower? Because year over year, as inflation increases your asset, the hard asset value, and increases your income, your ability to cover that $1,100 payment will get better and better and better. In other words, the purchasing power of the bank's return, that $1,100, is going to be eroded worse and worse as inflation gets stronger and stronger. That's why inflation is good for borrowers, bad for lenders. Anyway, so the Fed decided last week, let's nudge it back just a little bit here. Let's nudge it back. Okay, that's a nudged back a little bit. The dark line would be last week. So, what did we see happening here? Interestingly enough, the Fed didn't move to stop inflation. So look what's happening to yields across the board, but especially to the long yields, where inflation expectations would have their strongest effect on a yield. Do you see it? From last week to this week, pop. Isn't that interesting? So, in other words, you're actually seeing the markets, this mind of the market, this animal that is beyond all of its traders or any of its traders. The whole market has said, okay, the Fed made a move. Yeah, we can maybe understand the justification for it, but we have also increased the expected inflation premium. You see it? It just actually, you watch it embed a higher expected inflation premium. Because the inflation premium will, expected inflation premium will compound year over year. So out there in the long, that compounding will have a pretty serious effect on the back end of that. It's sort of like a bullwhip. I mean, you've used a bullwhip. Yeah, bro, you know, there are places where it's appropriate. You know, 50 shades of them, I've heard. But anyway, so when you tick it here, you get a thwack out there. That is what happens when expected inflation begins to be embedded. It has that magnifying effect on the longer instruments than it does on the shorter instruments. And sure enough, the Fed said, we are not going to deal with this today. We're not going to deal with this today. We're not going to deal with the inflation. We're going to hold interest rates steady. And so the markets say, that's cool, but now we have to put a stronger inflation, expected inflation premium in there. You follow it? Okay, now. Next place I'm going to take you, if I can do this, see if I can do this on the first shot. Seriously? Is there some reason this sucks? Do I need a hand crank to get the internet to work here? Okay, this is the Federal Reserve Economic Database. It is one of the greatest friends you can have for research projects in your classes because it'll make the charts itself. You tell it what you want it to chart, for what period of time you want it to chart, and this SOB will do the chart for you. It'll put charts on top of charts. It'll even make it into a JPEG that you can export. It's a really good system, and you might want to just keep this in mind. It's called the Federal Reserve Economic Database, FRED. And watch, part of this, I'm doing this today because this is a pretty light chapter, but also I'm doing it to show you a couple of things. But this gives you an idea of something very nice that you can do. Now, what I'm showing you here is the yield on 3 months Treasury bills. And I'm going to pull this forward. Let's get this out to 2000. Okay. There are the yields. There's the yield on a 3 month Treasury bill right there. And you can do this by different things, monthly, weekly, daily, and all this. But this is good enough. Now, notice that this was the effect over this period of 2004 up to about 2007. Really, 2007. The Federal Reserve was holding the M1 very tight. And so that kind of open market operations would make for high yields on Treasury bills. Because essentially through this period, the Federal Reserve was selling T-bills to banks. The banks would buy them with money that was then not available to people and companies. And the Federal Reserve selling them, the supply of T-bills went up, the price went down, and so the yields stayed high. You see how they were not even just holding them high, they were doubling down and pushing them higher and higher and higher. I'm not exactly the most popular person at the Fed for what I've called them. But there's a term for pushing discount rate higher and higher and higher when other economic data And I show this in some articles. Investment in the early 2000s was collapsing. Capital investment was. There was clear signs of instability and deep problems in the economy. And yet the Fed just kept pushing interest rate, the yield, up and up, starving M1. That's M1 going down. The Fed was effectively sucking money out of the economy. So the opportunity cost of money was going up. There it is. And so we ask the basic, very fundamental question. And if you're German, and I'm so going to erase that before someone photographs that. But you see what I mean there? Look at that. So, then suddenly, the information was clearly getting in there that there was something deeply unstable happening. And the Fed just turned course. But by then, it was too late. We were already over the cliff. We just didn't know it. Wile E. Coyote, when he runs off the cliff and he keeps going for a while and finally looks down. And yeah, there it was. Real mystery is what the hell they were trying to pull right there when they started contracting again. What was going through their minds? Oh, the recession is over. That's what we think they meant. They thought, oh, it wasn't all that bad after all. We better stop inflation. Well, that was a really good move, okay? Yeah, the guy with the heart attack actually moved his left foot, so let's take him off the ventilator. And that in itself probably at least added to the woes and made that, look at that, that's a seriously wide recession. And I mentioned this before. This gray band here, there was no recession. I've got these charts from back before they altered this to make it look like there was a recession to justify the massive tax cuts that went into place. There was no recession back there, none at all. But here, this was a serious one. It was a wide one, and it was a deep mofo. And that's a technical term, okay? Anyway. So there you go. See it? Now down there, they're just holding that thing down there at zero. The risk of that, though, is that with that kind of liquidity pouring into the economy, you'll eventually get inflation. Why we haven't gotten it? Probably because they had starved out the economy of money for so long that there's a huge, huge hole that could be filled with literally trillions of dollars before we begin to get a liquidity overhang. Anyway, now, let me take you down here. I want to show you something. Let's add a data series. See how easy this is. And then you can export these graphs. You can just pull these right out of JPEGs and do this kind of stuff. And I'm going to type in 30-year conventional, 30-year treasury. Add the series. And there it is. See how nice that is? Now here's something that's kind of fascinating. We did not issue 30-year treasury bills because we had paid, we were running budget surpluses in the late 90s. And they finally ran out in the 2000s. Before, therefore, a period of time, we didn't even need to borrow on 30-year debt. It was an awesome thing that was happening. But anyway, notice something about, there's a correlation. Do you see the correlation between the 30-year and the, this is sort of like a substrate. This is like a substrate underneath this one. But interestingly enough, notice all this volatility here. That would be the only thing that could be if we have a low inflation expectation environment. The only thing that could be is the maturity premium. This gap right here is the maturity premium. There's nothing else. There's no liquidity premium because government bonds can be sold anytime, anywhere. There wouldn't be a default premium because the government doesn't default on its debt. I told you, if the government absolutely has to, it'll just raise taxes or we'll just invade another country and take their money. We are not going to default, so there's no default premium. And if expected inflation was near zero for all that time because the Fed had just basically throttled the hell out of the economy, the only thing that could possibly be there would be a maturity premium. So you're seeing it visually happening here. Now, let me do one more. I wanted to pull off add a data series, and I'm going to type in 30 again. Conventional 30-year conventional mortgage rate. Add the series. Oh! That gap between the 30-year Treasury bond and the 30-year conventional fixed-rate mortgage would be the default premium. Do you see it? Because they'd be carrying the same maturity premium. There's no liquidity premium because banks sell these mortgages and packages every day. There's a massive, trillions of dollar market, Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, and all that kind of stuff, Freddie Mac. So that has to be the default premium. And there's something about that, the default premium. And we look at the red here. Notice how narrow the default premium was here in about 2011. But notice that it spreads. It doesn't stay the same. That's because the default premium itself doesn't stay the same. Banks are constantly reassessing probabilities of defaults on conventional mortgages. Right now, do you notice that the default premium has gotten larger over the last, about year? It's gotten pretty serious. That default premium is, see the default premium here during the recession? There was a high probability that people would default on their mortgages because people were losing jobs all the time. But as we came out, the default premium narrowed. A lot of banks saw a very good recovery coming along, especially small, medium-sized community banks, credit unions. But then it began to widen. Got narrow in here. Like I said, it's volatile. You can't say, this is because. Sometimes you can't. But when you see it spread and stay open, that's a concern. That means the banks are putting a fairly robust default premium, and it's not just a fluke. It's not just they got spooked by something. This is enduring. This has been going on for more than a year now. This has been going on for, more than a year. So, in other words, we can look at this economic data and then begin to make decisions as business people about capital investment, the opportunity cost of capital. What are we going to have to pay if we borrow money on a corporate bond? Because the last one I'm going to show you, if I can do it, is out of data series, 30 corporate. There's an index I can't remember what it is. Corporate bond. Really? Come on. Let me take this one off. It's getting confused by what I'm doing here. Let me get the conventional mortgage off it. Where's my damn, there it is. Throw it out. Remove. Okay, now I'm going to come back and get the data series again. I'm going to get 30-year corporate. 30-year corporate bond. Come on, tell me if you see me going past it. Let's try this. Corporate bond index. That should do it. AAA, Moody's, that's close enough for government work. Add the series. Interestingly, the same pattern, but this would be carrying the default premium as well. Notice it's a spread for corporates over government and mortgages over government, at least AAA corporate bonds, is almost identical, except that there's not this, not as much of a pinch as there was with the mortgages. But notice that this isn't just consumer debt. It's corporate debt as well. There's a spread there. That's the default premium. It hasn't been widening. It's actually been kind of serious for quite a while. So you have to decide, well, what does that possibly mean? By the end of this course, I'm going to have you, in very brief terms, in an essay on the final, in a sentence or two, explain why you see what you see in a group of graphs like this. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.